Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 94-year-old Tad Riley, a longtime pilot who grew up in Kansas and Pennsylvania. Tad and his wife of 67 years, Phyllis, have spent their last 11 years at Paradise Valley Estates in Fairfield, California, where most of his fellow military retirees served in the Air Force. Travis Air Force Base is right down the street, but Tad spent a quarter century flying in the Navy. Between propeller-driven planes and jets and helicopters, close to 20 different aircraft he's flown. You can see some photos of many of them at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. We're going to hear about the famous photos he took in a photo recon configured RF-8A Crusader in a while, but you were in the Navy for the transition from that propeller-driven era to jet engines. So can you give us a little perspective on how significant of a difference that was?
Well, the main difference is you're going faster all the time, but the jets are just the mechanics of driving them are simpler than a prop. There are a lot of things you have to do with a big propeller airplane with temperatures and thrust and pressures. A jet turbine, it runs or it doesn't. And so if you can start it, you can go.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, just another, and forgive me if some of these are dumb questions, but I have to think that if you flew that many different aircraft for that long, you probably had a few flights that didn't go as planned, where some curveballs were thrown your way, or you had to improvise, or maybe you weren't sure that you were going to make it to where you were going. Do you have some memories that stand out of some hairy situations in the air?
Well, I was stationed in Washington, and we had to get proficiency time. And at that time, they had T-1As, which was a Lockheed trainer. And I was giving an instrument check on a fellow, and he was taking off in the back seat under the hood, they called it. And it flamed out just after the wheels retracted. We were still over the runway, and so we walked home. But we had to eject through the canopy, and we were maybe 150 feet high when we did that. I ended up outside the main gate in a pigsty. I've spent some time in a farm when I was a kid, and I knew that pigs are carnivorous. They'll eat anything. And I was flat on my back in this kind of little mud puddle next to a barn. I heard thundering hooves, and I looked up, and here came about 15 or 20 pigs. And I thought, after all this, I'm going to get eaten by a pig. It just turned out they were little pigs. They were maybe 10 pounds. And they're real curious animals. And they just gathered around, oinking, and their little tails were spinning like a propeller. And this is the most exciting thing they'd ever seen. About that time, the farmer showed up in a Jeep and bundled me up. And we went through the base gate at Andrews Air Force Base. And we met the crash trucks coming out as we went in. And the operations was, he dropped me off, and that was a madhouse. You know, this plane hit on the freeway and blew up. They could see it from the White House, so I got my name in the paper. They didn't want to pay any attention to me because they had an accident, and they had more important things to do, and I had to convince them that I would have been in the accident. And I had a hand that was crushed in the process, and so I ended a couple of days in the hospital, but I kept going.
Well, a lot of things come to mind. First, I mean, I knew we were going to talk about the Cuban Missile Crisis, but I didn't know you were going to teach me about the Chesapeake Bay of Pigs.
Yeah. No, they were kind of cute, but, you know, when you're flat in your back and they're all standing around you, you kind of wonder what's going to happen.
Well, and the other thing, I mean, you described that whole sequence so matter-of-factly, but those of us who didn't live through it are listening and saying, holy moly, this is life and death. This has got to be incredibly scary. What goes through your mind in those moments where you have to make the split-second decision to eject?
I don't remember the weather. That's when you go into automatic. We were trained, and there wasn't any decision to make. You just had to go, and that's what we did. He got tangled up in a tree, and by the time he fell out of the tree, he broke his ankle. So he was in worse shape than I was.
Were you married already at this time?
Oh, yeah. And I had to call the wife and tell her to turn on the TV. because that's all they talked about for a while.
The plane that landed on the freeway?
Yeah. And fortunately, the chute probably opened when it was 100 feet, so I wasn't very, I only swung back and forth once. I never even looked up to see if it worked. I knew it had. I remember seeing a school bus on the freeway, but it got through before the plane hit, and the plane hit in an open between traffic. Almost got two guys in a Jeep. They tried to back up and couldn't get it in gear. But otherwise, they had a little burn, but not much. I think the car burned up, but they got out.
Well, I mean, I'm just thinking about it. This sounds like every pilot's nightmare, and you had to live through it, and you didn't know what the consequences were going to be, whether you were, I mean, because to eject at 150 feet, there's no guarantee you're going to survive, and you don't know what the plane's going to do.
It's all so fast, and it's just 2 or 3 seconds, and it's over, and there you are. It's kind of like having a close one on the freeway. You don't live with it forever. You know that could have been a bad one real easy,
Yeah. But
it wasn't, so you got through it.
So how'd you explain it to Phyllis?
I told her I was okay. That's all she needed to know.
Is that something, and I'm just thinking about that because, you know, so often we think about the person who's serving and we don't realize how much their family serves with them. Were there conversations that the two of you had over the years about the inherent risk to your duties?
No, she's a Navy wife, and that's part of the package, and she knew that. I don't think there's any doubt in my mind that I wasn't going to fly when I got married, and she knew it. Of course, I had already been flying when we got married, so.
Yeah, do you want to tell me the story of how you two met?
Blind date. I needed a date to go to a squadron party, and a buddy of mine had a girlfriend that wanted, she was looking too. So it went from there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And how long you been married now?
67 years.
So every time I meet someone who's been married that long, I know I'm not the only one who aspires to similar longevity. So what's your secret?
Why don't you say yes, dear?
And that's still working for you, huh?
Better.
I don't want to leave anything out, so if there are other aviation stories you want to mix in, I'm sure you could tell us a ton of them. But there's a photograph you have here. Well, there's a couple of them that are really unique. One of them's unique because it's the only time what happened in that photograph happened, and the other one is what created that one. So I want you to take us back to 1962, and a lot of people are familiar with the Cuban Missile Crisis in general, but maybe don't know the specifics of what was happening. Can you help us understand how much tension existed in the world in that time between the United States and the USSR?
Well, it was just the way it was. You didn't realize there was a lot of tension, and at the time there was a lot of controversy about Cuba because of Castro. It just came into power and was doing a lot of talking. And so you weren't surprised when things were, because some of the Cubans were coming across in little boats, and they'd tell you things, or they'd tell you what you wanted to hear, usually. So there was always a certain amount of tension. And as far as the Navy on the East Coast was concerned, that was our ocean. So, and of course, we had the base at Guantanamo that we'd go back for training. And so this whole period came along pretty fast. The Cuban crisis started for me more than most, I guess, in August. The actual crisis was in October. But in August, my commanding officer called me in and asked me to study Cuba and what our capability was of running missions in Cuba. And I remember the only thing I remember particularly, it was low-level, high speed. And not to discuss it with anybody else, destroy any paperwork I did. So I did, and I told them I was ready. I could give a briefing if it came to that, and that was in August. Then about the 18th or 19th of October, I was back driving out of the squadron parking lot going home, and he came out and flagged me down, told me to get to Washington as soon as possible. He gave me a phone number to call when I got there. He had already was getting a plane ready, and he had filed my flight plan. He said the weather's good, so it'd just be a visual flight rule. That was about really all he told me. And I remember I said, well, can I go supersonic? In those days, you couldn't fly over land supersonic. You could under certain circumstances above 20,000 feet. But the ceiling was 10. I figured, well, I can probably get to Washington in supersonic. So I asked him, I said, you said, as soon as I can. And he said, yes, as fast as you can get there, you get there. About an hour and a half later, I was in Andrews. It was kind of fun.
Kid in a candy store, huh?
Yeah, but they were in the midst. There was a hurricane off in the Caribbean that was heading, and then those, you always flew the plane someplace else, inland, get them out of the way. And they were getting ready to fly. The Navy had a couple hundred trainers, beach crafts, and T-28s, and a few T-birds. They didn't want to pay any attention to me because they had a problem. So well, I called the wife from there. They wouldn't let me use the phone. I called my wife from the VIP lounge and got her into it. And finally, I used the phone number they'd given me, and I didn't know who I was talking to, but I said I was there. And this he ended up being a Navy captain someplace. He said, well, what's wrong? Can't you make it? And I said, I'm here. He said, what do you mean, here? And I said, I'm at Andrews. I was told to call you as soon as I got there. And I heard him cover the phone, and he told his other people, hey, this guy's already here. Well, get some transportation. Give me the duty officer. Well, I'd already been talking to that. I was an aggravation to him. But he got on the phone, and he was a little huffy about it, and the next thing I knew, he was, yes, sir, no, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, we'll do what we can. And then he came back and he said, you have to go out in the back door. And I said, the back door of what? He said, the Pentagon. And he said, we have to find some transportation. The only thing we have left is the maintenance pickup truck. And I don't think we're allowed to take it off the base. But anyway, that's what we did. And it was an old Ford pickup truck with a floor shift. And you had to hold the shift in or it would pop into neutral. So we went all the way to Washington. And I had to go in the back door because I was in flight gear. And they didn't want me to go in the front door because there's press out there. And they'd wonder, that would look funny. And I got there. And they took me in, and there were four officers sitting around a table with a big map of Cuba. And they started asking me what we could do. And there was a door to the next room, and every so often an officer would stick his head in and ask a question. And all I could see in there was a big table with officers around, and I found out later that's what they called the tank. That was the Joint Chiefs, and LeMay was the only one I recognized that I could see. And I figured, this is getting serious. So we went round and round. The interesting thing is, there was never any mention of missiles. It was construction. I figured they were talking about U-2. We knew U-2s were flying over Cuba, so I'd figured that much out. Could we do this? Could we do that? They were very interested whether we needed aerial tanking to fly. And would we be better off flying out of Jacksonville with the station, where the squadron is stationed? At that time, I was attached to a light photographic reconnaissance squadron 62, which we normally operated off a carrier. And I said, well, we'd be better to go out of Key West. I'd cut 400 or 500 miles out of the mission. Well, they thought that was fine. And the next thing I knew, they gave me a folder sealed and to get back down to give it to my commanding officer. I had a little problem getting out because they wanted me to evacuate my airplane to Memphis, and I didn't want to go to Memphis. I wanted to go to Jacksonville. And so finally, they told me that I had to go to Memphis, and that was an order. So I said, okay, and I got in my plane. That's another story we won't get involved in here, but it was kind of tricky getting somebody to help me start it because they were all manning other airplanes, and it was a chaos, actually.
Because everyone knows how urgent this situation is?
Yeah, because they thought they were flying away for this hurricane. And of course, no one that flew those air, they were every different office of the Navy in the Washington area. There wasn't one squadron or air group you could contact to get the pilots in. And this was, and most of the airplanes needed two. It was quite an exercise they were going through for the first time. So it was when I took off, they thought I was going to Memphis, and I didn't. I went to Jacksonville. I created a little problem later.
So you disobeyed the order?
Yes. My CO, the XO, met me, and I gave them their envelope. That was about 1 o'clock in the morning, I guess. And they said, go home and get a good night's rest and come back. Well, anyway, the next day we came back, and we had assigned pilots. There were going to be six of us, three flights of two. And I was going to lead one, the commanding officer going to another one, and there was another lieutenant commander there is leading the third group. The CO had the choice. His mission was just outside of Havana. And so we had our missions, and all we had was a map with various locations just circled, and latitude, longitude written down. There's nothing to indicate. And I had already asked them, you know, when I was in Washington, what were we looking for? And they said, unusual military activity or construction. That's all we knew. So the next day, that was about the 21st, we flew down to Key West, while everybody else flew to Memphis and other places, and we just went the other direction, and so that gave us a good cover. The plan was just to land and gas up and go. Well, we got there, and they told us to hold. Okay, so we held the whole next day, and then the next morning, we went out, and we were man-sitting in the planes, ready to go, and then they told us to stand down, which was just as well. You don't want to sit in an airplane in Key West in October any longer than you have to. So they brought in a whole squadron of F-104s from George Air Force Base, which was down by Los Angeles. And I think they had to tank three or four times to get down there, and they made it. They were going to be our escort. They weren't to go over land. They were to stay off the coast. So the next morning, we got ready, and this time we were just sitting in the ready room. We weren't going to go out and sit in those airplanes.
In a hurricane?
Yeah, and by this time the hurricane had really fiddled out. It had never even went anyplace, but they said go. So on the 23rd in the morning, about 10 o'clock in the morning, we took off. I had three targets. One was a missile base near Sagra La Grande, which is about 100 miles east of Havana, and then there was a Santa Clara, I believe, was their jet MiG base, and they wanted to see what they was going on there. And then there was another suspicious area up by Remedios, which is a pretty good-sized town along the north coast.
So they knew they were going, but how would they pull it off, and how would it all unfold? Perhaps the bigger question is, what might have happened if they didn't? Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for a video with Tad Riley and photos relating to his story. We'll be right back after this.